So in thinking about today, coming down here to our group and sitting with you, I thought that this might be a good day for me not to talk so much, or not to start with the talking, but rather to give you a chance to ask questions. I think it's a good thing for us to do periodically, and we haven't done it for quite a while, and it gives me a chance to hear, you know, what's going on and concerns you have. And I don't think people come on a regular basis to practice something like meditation or insight meditation unless it has some importance in their lives. And a lot of people here in the room practice regularly every day. And even if a person just comes weekly, and I think it's a big undertaking to do. And life has often a lot of demands, a lot of things, a lot of other things you could do instead. So I have much appreciation that it's very important for many people who come. And I was wondering what kind of concerns or questions you might have about your practice or about the practice in general that somehow comes out of that sense of importance that it has for you. Yes, please, Hilda. Why don't you say your name before you start? Question.
My name is Hilda. I noticed that when I'm meditating at home or here or in the Sangha, you know, it's really easy to be more my best self. But taking the first aid and CPR class the other day, and every once in a while certain things come up, and it's like, if I ever have to use these skills, I really want to be more in that place that I'm, that deeper place of meditation, and like, I want more control over being able to access that in my daily life, to be able to remember quickly and skillfully do that. Do you have any advice?
You know, having wants is a two-edged sword. So on one hand, I hear the sincerity of your want and how beautiful it is, and like to support that. And the other hand, maybe not for you, but for many people who have that kind of wish, it's also a setup to suffer more, because we don't live up to our ideals or how we think we should live, or, you know, and we come into situations where we think we should have been more present, more mindful, more compassionate, but we weren't. And so then we measure ourselves against, you know, other ways of being, how we think we should have been. And if you come to if you do a regular practice, then sometimes you have a sense of your potential, a possibility of way that comes across much purer, with greater compassion and presence. And it highlights even more how we're not that sometimes, and it can seem even worse, you know, worse off than we started. Because so you have to be very discerning or wise about our wants and how we hold these things. I think that in times of crisis, which, you know, when you're using CPR, it's a time of crisis. Part of it is having done a lot of practice beforehand. So it's kind of like, it's kind of become a habit, or you have a certain stability that's already there. And if you're expecting practice, to call on your practice, you don't practice on a regular basis, but you call on your practice, you know, in a time of crisis, you don't have as many resources to call upon. But if you practice regularly, then it's there with you. It kind of you carry it along with you, certain kind of strength, certain kind of presence, certain kind of skills of mindfulness and presence that are helpful. And one of the skills that I find very helpful is to regularly check into my body, find out what's going on in my body. So there are times in my life where that's just almost automatic. And so I find myself in difficult situations, and I'll check into my body, and my body does a very number of things for me. One is that it shows me what's going on for me, if I've tightened up or gotten tense or anxious or whatever. My body also shows me, by checking in with my body, it kind of a little bit tends to break the trance that I might have if I'm caught up in my thoughts, my concerns, my anxiety about certain situation. It kind of creates a little bit sense of independence, or I don't want to say distance because that suggests maybe the wrong thing, but a little sense of independence in the midst of it. And it's kind of stability in their body, and not so caught by it. The And the last thing I'll say is that your intention that you expressed was quite beautiful. And that intention, I think, is there in other situations, hopefully, than just, you know, a crisis where you need CPR. And the more you can act on your intentions, the stronger those intentions become in your life, or more those intentions are ready at hand in situations where you most need them. If we have good intentions but don't act on them, then they don't kind of sink in as deeply. They don't take root as deeply. So even in small ways, to begin acting on our intentions to wake up, be present, to be compassionate, builds a certain momentum and then carries over into times of crisis. Yeah, Rainbow.
I notice most of the time when you talk about noticing when your thoughts take you away from your breath, to just come back to your breath. Recently, though, I've heard you suggest some other relationship that they have to each other. And I remember when I heard it, I was moved by it, that it was something about moving, putting your breath back to your attention, or some other way of stating it that just, it's interesting.
Okay.
What was that?
Okay. Well, it's very common in meditative circles to talk about bringing the mind back. The mind goes off, and we bring it back. And it's, you know, it's in a kind of colloquial way of speaking, it's fine. But does your mind really go anywhere? And that kind of image or idea of the mind going somewhere and bringing it back lends itself to kind of being active with the mind, actually kind of sense sometimes of moving the mind. And sometimes people will pounce back at the breath, you know, jerk the mind. The mind goes off in the thought, you know, and then you jerk it back. And sometimes people are actually quite harsh around how they come back, and the mind wanders off, and they're judgmental about that. They're upset, and this is perfect proof that you're a bad meditator, and therefore, you know, let's, you know, and all kinds of things happen that are all extra, not needed. So the idea of kind of moving the mind is kind of a little bit strange and suspect vocabulary, even though it's used a lot. And other things are just as valid way of talking. So another way of talking is when you notice your mind has drifted off, maybe, or when you're lost in thought, then bring your breath back to your mind. So when you've noticed that your mind has wandered off, when you notice that you're lost in thought, whatever the description you want to use, at that point, when you notice, there is mindfulness there already. And so to honor the mindfulness already there is somewhat unusual. Usually we then follow that by a little judgment. I'm in the wrong place. I shouldn't have been drifting off. I should be with the breath. But just before those judgments, there was a moment of pure awareness. Oh, here I am wandering off. And to appreciate that, and then realizing that awareness is already there, then invite the breath back into that awareness. And then the mind is not moving. The mind is still. And it's actually the nature of the mind to be still. So we're coming back to its true nature. Is that making sense? Yeah.
Richard, I have a couple questions, but I started sitting in 1984 with Sister Aya Kim on a long retreat, and it was essentially a little different style than noting sati.
Patana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I did some Goenka, and I did a variety of different Buddhist practices, Roshi Aiken, and so forth and so on. And then, because I was on Maui, and Kamala and Steve, and kind of continued in that tradition of the noting and so forth, and Jack, and this whole sort of tradition that most of us are teaching, Spirit Rock teachers, and so forth and so on. Of late, I've been reading a lot of Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Chah, and they de-emphasize, it seems, the noting in terms of practice technique. And emphasize, because they're monks, the precepts, sila, you know, those kinds of things that the precepts for us, to, if we live our life, you know, as attentive as we can to the precepts, then everything else will take care of itself. That's ajajas, you know, kind of let go a little, get a little, let go of everything, get everything. And so it's a simpler practice. And all the years that I practiced, there's been a sort of an earnestness, you know, like Adrian Ross talked about, clobbering each thing that comes into awareness. Oh, boom! Thinking about it, you know, bam, bam, bam. You know, and it's like, you know, it's like, it was funny because it's really, it can happen to us. You know, we get stuck in this, oh, there's a thought, there's a feeling, bang, bang, bang. You know, like we're at a carnival, you know, shooting these things down. And of late, I've kind of given up the noting. You know, just sort of, I'm going to sit here and see what happens. Well, that brings me to the second. I wanted to see what your point of view about that is. You know, first of all, that sort of playing around with these different traditions, the Thai versus Burmese and so forth. Because, you know, Sayadaw Upandita is like, boom, you know. It, you know, bam, 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 continuity, you know, just like, and so that was one quick thing, and then the last, the other thing is personal. I've had tinnitus, very loud tinnitus for a long time, many years.
And it's being supported right now.
Yeah, not really, but it's a different frequency. But long retreats especially, you know, come into play. But of late, because of some other conditions, I've got it pretty serious. And I was listening to a talk by Ajahn Sumedho and Amaro saying that they listen, you know, they put their attention on that silence or on what they, you know, and I'm thinking, this can't be my mind. This has got to be, it's so loud that if I put my attention on it, it starts to make me nervous because it doesn't tend to arise and pass away. My attention to it arises and passes away, which is the same, in a way, the same point you were just making.
Right.
But I've been advised by other teachers, Steve and so forth, not to make that my primary object of attention. So that was my personal question to you. What is your position on a loud, predominant sound in our heads?
My position. Well, I don't have a policy paper on this yet. But I'm working on it. there is in the tradition, both in a little bit in the Theravada tradition and certainly in the Mahayana tradition, the idea of non-abiding nirvana, non-abiding nibbana. And non-abiding has a sense of having no position, have no place where we rest. And the idea of having views and opinions is understood in the tradition to be very potentially dangerous and a source of suffering, certainly for our neighbors, if not for ourselves. And so the attitude we have or the relationship we have to opinions, views about practice is very important in the tradition, not to cling to it, not to hold on to it, not to have fixed views. One of the first fetter that's removed, a classic description of what gets removed or what you're liberated from as you become liberated, is the clinging to virtue, to precepts, and clinging to religious practices. So it isn't just an attachment to views and opinions that are pointed towards being a problem. You can actually cling to religious practices also. So there are, you know, scores and scores of different ways of practicing mindfulness. And you went through a list of some of the options that are around. There's a lot of other options also. And then how do we relate to all the different ways of practicing? And I know some people will feel that, you know, theirs is the true way, this is the best way, and some of that's kind of innocent, it's just this is what they know and they're enthusiastic, you know. And so you kind of, you know, listen politely and kind of appreciate their enthusiasm. And sometimes it has a little bit of a fundamentalist quality. You know, this is the other people don't do it right, and this is the true way. And then the question is then, how do we find ourselves? How do we negotiate all the different practices that are being offered if we encounter many of them? And what do we do about finding our own practices with our own experience, like your tinnitus? And I think part of it is remember that the Buddhist tradition focuses on skillful means. The word upaya kusala is a very important term in the tradition, skillful means. And skillful means is that means that is skillful in any given situation. What's helpful for you to move you towards greater liberation and to the fruits of the spiritual life. And we need to recognize that different people have different doors to the Dharma, different ways, different means which are helpful for them. And I'm very fond of the story of the Buddha, where he was sitting probably under a tree sometime, and he was pointing around to his various senior disciples who are around different places in the woods there. And he said, oh, over there is Shariputra. And those people who are really into studying wisdom, they sit there and practice with him. And all those people who are really into meditation, they go over there and study with Mahamudgalyana. And those over there who really like precepts and living the monastic life, following the precepts well, they're over there with Upali. And the people over there, you know, and so you get a sense that the Buddha was appreciating how different personalities are and different people are, and appreciating that each of these people had, you know, their own way that they found. And so maybe there are many doors. And so to have some idea of a one way or the best way, the only way, I think is a problem for when you're talking to many people at once. The mental noting is a technique that, as you said, that the Mahasi tradition made a lot of. It became a central feature of the Mahasi tradition. And that's the kind of primary meditation tradition which informed the teachings at IMS and at Spirit Rock and my own teaching. And so, however, the teachers in the West don't put the same, for the most part, there are exceptions, of course, but as a group, don't put the same level of importance for mental noting as some of the teachers in Burma do. It's still emphasized, but there's lots of leeway given to not to use it. And often, I once was going to give a whole talk at Spirit Rock on mental noting, and the other teacher said, oh, they got kind of nervous. You know, people get the wrong impression, or what about the people who don't do mental noting, and they're going to feel it's not okay. So there's much more latitude here, you know, to do different ways, and recognizing that it's not appropriate for everyone to do mental noting. Also recognizing there's different ways of doing mental noting. You don't have to do it for every possible experience, but some people only mentally note their thinking, or only use mental noting for their breath, or for the feeling tone of experience, kind of special ways of doing it. So different skillful means, different ways of finding it. One of the principles that became very important for me as I was encountering Vipassana in Burma, in Asia, was it became very clear to me that the development of the practice over time had a lot to do with trial and error. That the teachers would give you advice, and, you know, teachers give you great advice. You know, you come here to IMC and I give you brilliant advice, right? And it really doesn't mean that much. I mean, it's good, hopefully. But what really counts is that you get some ideas of how to practice, and then you try it out, and you see what works. And no, I don't think any teacher can really tell you how to practice. They give you kind of broad brushstrokes for practice, and then as you try to do it, then you kind of find the nuances of how to do it for yourself, and how to personalize it, and find out what works for you. And there's a process of trial and error that goes on. You try this little bit, and that seems to work, or that doesn't seem to work. So then you make a little adjustment, and does that seem to work? And there's kind of a process of discernment that goes into the practice. And part of the discernment is to notice whether you're being too agitated, too exploring too much, and never settling down, and always looking and trying and being restless, and looking for all kinds of things. There has to be a subtleness and relaxation as you go into the practice. For tinnitus, I've heard various advice about it. One advice that I've heard is ignore it. This is not a use. Upanita, he never talked about tinnitus, but There are a couple of things that Upandita said. Don't pay. Even though he said, even the rhetoric was pay attention to everything, but don't pay attention to these things. And so one of the things was don't pay attention to your heartbeat. Don't let that be kind of so focused for attention. You might know it a little bit here and there, but don't kind of focus on it. And I've heard people say don't focus on the tinnitus. And I've heard people who suggest taking it on as a practice. And Ajahn Amaro is the person I know the most. Mm-hmm. And he calls it the nada.
That's right.
And he kind of finds support from it from a Hindu tradition. There's some texts in Hinduism that focus on the inner sound. And the fact that it doesn't change lends it is very supportive in his view. And it kind of is tending towards stilling of the mind and towards that the unchanging reality of Nibbana. And I've never followed that sound myself. I've had it sometimes very strong on retreats and was troubled by it. And never, I don't feel like I ever really was able to, on retreat, come to a place of great equanimity and comfort or whatever, just allowing that sound to be there. Sometimes it comes, and sometimes it comes very strongly if you develop concentration. Then sometimes concentration will lock on to things that you don't want it to lock on to. You know, we're trying to get our concentration focused and centered on something. and finally it gets, you know, there and it centers on the wrong thing. You know, you're trying to do your breath and it centers on this tinnitus, you know, please. Or, you know, sometimes a little bit more commonly, you know, you get this concentration going and it locks on to writing the great American novel. And, you know, you can't get off it. Because that's where the concentration is going. And then some point that you get off it and you go on with your practice. So I've gone on and on trying to.
No, I appreciate it.
Use it.
Helpful. Thanks.
Bonnie.
Hi, Bonnie. Two questions, but they're related to the same thing. This week we found out that a relative has a life-threatening illness. And as you know, it's been 3 years of death and illness and all sorts of things. So my kids' reaction is, cursed. This family's cursed. And I had such a different reaction that I've been holding all week, which is, we're chosen. I feel like our family's been chosen to handle a lot of adversity, and I find it an anchor of strength. But as I've shared it with people outside this community, people are kind of looking at me and responding without kind of reading two lines, like, smile, or having to have this kind of reaction, or it's going to shift. But it's about someone to get your reaction to ask this question. Is that a good way of feeling? It's holding me in a very positive way, not to deny the fear and the sadness, all that's still there.
It might be a great way of holding it. It's hard to know. For sure, the attitude that we're cursed seems unfortunate one to hold. And if simply the pendulum is swinging to the other side, and it's kind of this playing the same game of judging our experience in some way, or holding, evaluating our experience in such a way that, you know, that we overlay it with an understanding, a sense of meaning, that it's kind of playing the same game. Maybe it's not useful to say we're chosen. And maybe not having any meaning at all, just meeting the moment as it is what's needed. That we have such a strong, meaning making kind of tendency in the mind to make meaning out of it, and conclusions, large scale conclusions, rather than just focusing on this is what's happening right now, and let's just take care of this the best way we can. If the attitude that we're chosen is one that supports you looking for how to practice in the situation, how to purify oneself, how to find in difficult situations, come forth for the best within us, how to value our capacity to meet situations with kindness and service, and feel so unfortunate. It's unfortunate circumstances, but here we're given the opportunity to be of service and be compassionate And this is really wonderful. And to appreciate that as a kind of a, an opportunity, I think that's beautiful to do that way. In my own mind, I would probably be reluctant to go around telling people I feel chosen, just kind of casually, because I think people will hear it in funny ways. People won't understand what it means. You might say something like, instead, I can imagine saying something like, it is unfortunate that these things are happening. It's hard. And I get comfort, I find support, I find strength in understanding that there's also an opportunity here. And try to meet this in a way that, tries to help the world or help myself or help others or my family or try to cultivate my compassion or, I don't know.
That does sound better. So the second part is, and it's, that anything can trigger what I'm about to say, related to mindfulness. But after this news came, the next day I had a silly but, unfortunate accident in the shower because I can get, I wasn't consciously thinking about it. My unconscious is constantly working on these things. So I had an accident, and then I ran through a red light, not even noticing it yesterday, and that could have been very, very dangerous. So when we're the question is when we're working on something, both on the surface and very deeply, how to really be bringing mindfulness to the floor, because it can be very destructive when it's not there.
Yeah, I understand. What I suspect is that it would be very useful to give yourself some quality time to let the deeper currents bubble up and work and process themselves, so they don't necessarily have to process themselves in other times when you can kind of shower. It's kind of a time when a lot of the concerns of life fall away a little bit. And so I can imagine things bubbling up, or imagine your mind sinking into these concerns and dealing with them, kind of like with sleep sometimes, the same way. The daily meditation practice is one, for example, or journaling, or there's various ways of giving yourself some quality time to let yourself sink into the deep currents of what's going on for you, deep feelings, and it might also sometimes be opening up to the difficulty, the horror, the pain of this kind of stuff, and only by doing that during quality time, can you then more realistically look for the opportunity in the situation as you address it in daily life, kind of on the surface of things. And then also, if you take care of these things, and your mind knows you have time to take care of these things in a quality way, then when you are driving, maybe the mind is less likely to be pulled into that world, and you stay more attentive. Yes?
My name is Jim. I have a practice question. I've been dealing with pain from the release of tension in my back, described to me by my teacher as Dharma pain. And I know associated with the strong sensations, there are also emotions put often of fear and of hatred. And I'm not sure that I can really find in my body sensations associated with the aversion that seem different than the strong sensations of the release. So I was wondering how I'm working on trying to see if I can see the aversion, the fear, and the hatred, and the dislike of what's going on, to see if those somehow separately or distinct from the strong sensations.
Oh, I see. So there's a strong sensations in your back, and that seems to be associated with fear and hatred. Those emotions seem to be in that environment.
Specifically, I can be following a strong sensation in my back, and then there'll be a time it'll suddenly start to get a little stronger,
uh-huh.
And I'll feel some contraction, which I think is like there's fear that it's going to get worse.
Oh, I see. So I see.
Yeah, not fear or hatred of something else. Right. It's of the experience.
Oh, great, good. I see that.
So how do you, I've been working this for a while, but how would one look, try to see those emotional reactions to the experience differently than the experience itself. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense now, yes. I remember times where I've had a lot of knee pain and in meditation. Watching, the relationship between my mind and the pain, and seeing how when I started having thoughts of self-pity, that I would my muscles would tighten up around the pain and it would get worse. And so I could see the thoughts, I could see the tightening around the pain, and I knew that tightening around the pain was not the pain itself, but rather had to do with how the mind was reacting to it. And it was really clear. Sometimes it's been really clear. One way to investigate one other thing I found useful sometimes when I've been spending a lot of time focusing on my body in meditation, body sensations, is periodically backing off from the body and noticing what else is going on. What are the feelings that might be there? What are the thoughts, the beliefs, the attitudes that are going on also at the same time? Because sometimes if you're staying very close to the mindfulness of the body, it's very easy to miss some of the other things going on that need attention in order to kind of take in the whole situation. So sometimes shifting the focus a little bit can be useful to kind of get a bigger aspect of what's going on. My strongest sense listening to you is I wonder whether it's necessary to be so so diligent.
Well, the reason that the motivation for that was that my teachers on this retreat were talking about seeing if you could watch the aversion all the way to its end.
Uh-huh.
So kind of see it distinctly so that the sensation may still be there, but when the aversion to it would come and go.
Right.
See if you could see it coming and going. But I couldn't, I'm not sure that I could see something that I would call the aversion,
uh-huh,
distinct from physical sensation. Mm. Well enough that I could see it kind of changing. Yeah. That was my motivation.
Yeah, it's a good one. I mean, some things we don't see until we've watched for a long time, and so you have to be patient, just look and watch, and sooner or later something will be revealed, and oh, that's how it is. And sometimes when we have an idea of what we're looking for, it turns out it's not that way after all. And so I spend, hours and days and months, looking for something that's not even there. Oh, wow, that was a waste of time.
Next one is teach.
Certainly it's very valuable to explore and look and kind of study more carefully what you're doing. But you have to be a little bit careful also not to overdo it. And the way I was trained in Burma was there wasn't any real poking around like that or an analytical way. You just were content to be very mindful of what was actually here without any idea that you're looking for something or looking for something different or looking for some way. So if there's pain right now, then become very attentive to that pain. And then if that reveals itself as being different qualities of that pain or different reactions to it, then great, then study those nuances that you notice, but you don't have to do anything but be relaxed about noticing what's actually here. And so the Vipassana question that a Vipassana student could carry with them all the time is the question, what is this? And the question, what is this, is what is this that's already arisen? This that I've already noticed, what's this? That's what's already here. Can I look at this more carefully? Can I see this more carefully? But not so much to kind of look behind it, but just to see it more clearly. I don't know if that made sense. And then those things might be revealed, but so I wasn't there, at the retreat, knowing how the teachers were advising you and what was happening to you. So it's hard for me to respond, but I know that generically, my general approach would be to encourage someone to be very simple about the mindfulness, simple but very precise, rather than be having that kind of looking too much for something.
Can I make a comment? Because I'm wondering whether our attachment to trying to see this experience, the grasping, is an element that could arise as a result of that. Folk, you know, you look very deeply, you want to penetrate, you want to, sort of look for the impermanence. But we can become very attached to that too, and our minds can wither, as you know, in a sense around that. You know, we lose our freshness, you know, looking so hard at something.
Right. We can be too diligent, we can be trying so hard, be attached to seeing a certain way. Or we can hear from somewhere from a book or a teacher that our experience is supposed to be a certain way, and then we're trying so hard to make it that way or to see it that way, and it could just get in the way, make us tense and brittle. Yes?
Did you say simple but precise?
At times with mindfulness practice, you want to be very precise with the mindfulness. We talk sometimes about having putting on different lenses on our awareness. Sometimes you have a broad-angle lens and you kind of take a panoramic view of what's happening, and that's how you are in the present moment. And other times you take a close-up lens and you get very, very precise, and you're down to almost like the atomic level, seemingly the cellular level of the experience. And that's what's called for in the practice. And part of the art then, this trial and error, the art is knowing which lens to have at any given time. And sometimes it's appropriate to switch lenses. Like I was talking to Jim, that sometimes I'll look, be very much in my body, very precise, but then after doing that for maybe 5 minutes or something, then I might take a broad angle lens for a few seconds just to check out, am I missing something here? Am I kind of focusing so much that I'm actually not paying attention to what needs to be noticed right now? So I'll just take a broad angle lens for a while, and then sometimes something reveals itself that I should pay attention to instead, and sometimes it becomes clear I should go back to what I was paying attention to. Steve?
I've also found that if you address that low, that high magnification lens really close, if you're not attentive, there could be something else going on and using not very good effort. And so as soon as you sense that, you become intense, being as low, open the lens, and then relieve that pressure and keep the attention.
Yeah. Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Jesse. And I'm just more new at this. And I'm finding that I seem to be getting more isolated from my friends. You know, I really, at this time of my life, I'm kind of lost, and I'm like meeting the family, and, you know, the friends have been around for 8 years. And yet I find that when I go to places, I don't want to, that holds nothing for me anymore. You know, this noise and all the stuff. And then when I talk to them, I say, well, you're not there. You know, you never invited me. And I said, well, you know, you're into your own thing. you're going to these meditations, and what do you want? You know, do you want to come with us? And I'm getting, and then for a while, the last 2 weeks, it was, well, I go with them, you know, because I feel lonely and at home, especially the holiday time. And then I go there, and there's a part of me wanting to come here and say, you know, I've got to balance myself. But I'm finding that I'm pulling more away problem. I'm not really interested in what the conversations are. I feel like I'm finding it less uncommon.
I think what you're describing, I think a number of people have that kind of experience, and certainly I've had that experience. The kind of the representative experience for me like this was, I was living on a small farm, and I started having a daily sitting practice when I was about 20, 21. And I would come down to breakfast after meditating with my two friends who lived on the farm, and it was kind of like Gil wasn't there. You know, I didn't have anything to, it was quiet. I felt pretty content, felt no need to say anything at all, and just would sit down at the breakfast table, and just things were great, but I was quiet. And they expected the old guilt to be there. And I could felt over the days this tension build up because they didn't understand what that meant. And I didn't have the skills to explain to them what was going on. And so it was awkward for them. And maybe in their eyes, that kind of silence represents social awkwardness or tension or conflict that's going on. So it made it even worse for them. So at some point I decided with the poor understanding I had then was I either had to give up meditation or give up my friends. So I gave up meditation for a while so that I could stay living with my friends there and not have that get in the way. Sometimes as we meditate, our values change, the way we like to be in the world change. Another story I've told sometimes like this is a little bit related to this is when I had moved to San Francisco to be a Zen student at San Francisco Zen Center, I had a girlfriend. And well, at that time, I was aware of how many people play social games. Kind of, they want to they play games in order to get. Back then, the word that my girlfriend used was strokes. They want to be seen in a certain way, supported in a certain way. They want support in their ego and their identity and their egotistical way, way of holding themselves. And I saw many of these games, and I wasn't really interested in playing them. So she wanted strokes, and I just didn't respond. And so that relationship ended pretty quickly. But many years later, what I realized was that I had a certain kind of wisdom where I saw these things. But what I lacked at that time was compassion. And that if I had understood her situation more from the inside of what motivated or prompted her to want that, the suffering underneath her, I probably would have responded to her differently rather than been distant or aloof or unresponsive. So your experience is something that a lot of people have. I think it is awkward. There are times when people get involved in meditation circles or different circles where they do pull back from their normal life, their other life, the friends and stuff, in ways which are not helpful, that are isolating in ways that I wouldn't recommend people to do it. And other times it just seems like it's completely appropriate to do it because it's going so much in opposite directions from what we're trying to do with our lives. And it's so uncomfortable to be in certain settings. And so how you negotiate that, I don't know. I wouldn't jump into the meditative world too quickly. I like to do things slowly. Sometimes I think slow transitions can be wiser. And you might see if you can reframe how you understand your relationships with your friends. And it might be other ways of relating to them or understanding those friendships that can get bring value to you again. So like my example of not having compassion for my girlfriend, maybe there's some way of seeing them through the eyes of compassion rather than through the eyes of what this relationship can do for me or something. Or maybe you can tune in to the goodness that's in them and then relate to them through the goodness and talk to them about the things that are meaningful for you it's kind of art of finding the way of having a conversation with them where you talk about things that are valuable for both of you or deeply meaningful. And if they want to talk about who the 49ers are playing today, then you can say something like, I'm studying, joy is an important part of the tradition I'm part of. What kind of joy is it that you have when you watch the 49ers? and then they can talk about that joy, and that becomes an excuse to kind of take the conversation, talk about all the different kinds of joy there might be, So maybe there are ways of keeping the friendships and changing the way. And they finish the conversation with you and say, "Wow, that was a great conversation. Wow, I didn't know there was we could talk about joy in such a great way." And you've stopped talking about 49ers long ago in the conversation, so it works for you. So I don't know. So good luck. Having friends for whom or acquaintances who share some of your new values and new ways of being are very important. And that's one of the reasons why it's important to have a community like this where you come and you don't feel like you're the only one who's crazy, but you realize there's a group of people who's crazy and a group of people who are exploring the same thing. You're not alone. It's very helpful. And if you have a couple of, just even one or two people you have a little more of a friendship with who are in these circles, it's helpful. then kind of the caveat for that, at least you know my position paper on this issue, is that I kind of suspect that if all your friends and acquaintances are from a particular group or from a particular kind of religious spiritual tradition, then you should try to figure out some way to have friends and acquaintances outside of that, and don't just keep only within certain bounds, and so you get some fresh perspectives and step outside, so it's 10:45, and I appreciate a lot hearing those questions. I hope that this was useful morning for the rest of you and for listening to this, and hopefully people who asked the questions asked questions that were relevant for some of the rest of you also, and maybe were useful for part of the discussion. And just to express my appreciation for coming here Sunday morning and sitting with you all. I think it's really lovely and a wonderful thing to do, and it was nice to sit with you this morning. Thank you.